Indeed it is. And our very special guest tonight, Eldon Taylor. And we're going to take your phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM. Eldon, before we go to the many calls, let me ask you this very bizarre question.
Okay.
What causes the human body to laugh? It makes no sense.
You know, the answer to that is really unknown. There are lots of theories. Some of them are evolutionary in their nature. You know, arguably, some would tell you that laughter is an outgrowth of panting, and that we see that in primates. If you tickle a primate in what we think of as ticklish areas, I have trouble with that. You know, what I do know about laughter is it's complicated. First of all, it's a universal language, and it's contagious. You know, when you hear people laughing, you laugh right along with them. And indeed, I think of it as a kind of primordial language. We have a humor program, and on that humor program, I have laughter embedded subliminally, simply because I know that it causes you to smile. It causes you to laugh. You know, at the same time I say that, and I think I tend to believe this. Now, the literature is going to go in different directions, but there is support for this belief, too. I tend to believe that it's a signal that signals, you know, I'm friendly, or signals relief. I'll never forget this, George. Years ago, when I was, you know, conducting lie detection every day, I'd have coffee with a good friend who was the chief of police in South Jordan, Utah.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we happened to have coffee one morning, and he told me about a young woman that had come in that, you know, had alleged a gang rape by some young men that had put her in a van and driven her up one of the canyons. And as he sat and told me about it, I said, well, what is it about her that you don't believe? Because it sounded credible to me. And he says, oh, well, she's just laughing. You know, all the time she's telling us about this, she's laughing. You know, I had to stop and educate my dear friend at that moment that, you know, sometimes laughter is a relief. It turned out that this girl really was raped, and, you know, there were confessions by the young men involved. But it may have just been discharged because laughter is often misunderstood. Data shows us clearly that you will laugh much more often to non-related issues, that issues that you don't think, you don't normally associate with laughter. For example, if we compare joke lines, what percentage of your laughter is due to joke lines as opposed to all the other means that seem to produce laughter, mm-hmm. We find that that's a very small percentage. So I tend to think it's a complex form of communication. It probably is doing two things. It has the ability of saying, I feel safe, I'm relieved, I'm, you know, I'm embarrassed, but I'm safe, as with the young woman who was trying to describe a very painful act and compensating with her laughter. Or it also expresses a level of non-hostility. The other thing about laughter that I find absolutely, you know, wonderful and is that it is not just a universal language and not just contagious, but it probably should be our salutation. If there were some way for us to generate spontaneous laughter on command that was really sincere, what better way would there be to greet a person? Because it is an honest expression of the joy of life, you know? So the answer is I can't tell you what it's caused by. If you can tell me what it's caused by, boy, I'd love that. But I'm not aware of any research.
Well, if I knew, I wouldn't be asking you.
Well, I'm not aware of any researcher that's out there that is going to say definitely this is what it is. I'm sure that the overall conclusion is, we really don't know, but these are all the other things that we should consider. And by the way, while you're considering laughter, a lot of people aren't aware that when you laugh, you're changing your facial muscles, but not just your facial muscles. You're also changing other muscles. The muscles in your arms are being flexed. But in changing the facial muscles, you're signaling the brain. And I used to tell people, you know, you can fake it till you make it. And this is what I mean by that. You're not feeling good. You're in a bad mood. Just curl up the corners of your mouth. Pull a smile onto your mouth. Because in just forming a smile on your face, your brain doesn't know you're faking. It pours those endorphins into the system again. It says, oh, we're having fun. Well, here, have some wonderful neurochemicals.
Excellent. Let's take some calls, Eldon. They're lining up for you.
Great.
We'll pick it up. We'll go to Gene, west of the Rockies. You're on the air with us. Hi, Gene. Go ahead.
Hi. Great show.
Thank you.
My question has to do with courage. The Abu Ghraib torture situation was a closed system with secrets. And this is the hard part. Even the Catholic Church's Guide to Confession frames honesty and openness as a sin by asking the devotee if he has divulged any secrets. Yet that the way that Abu Ghraib was exposed was when the soldier went outside the system. And my point is, one must be willing to be ruined and punished if one betrays the secrecy of a closed system, like Abu Ghraib. So my question is, where does even a moral person find that courage? Is there a psychology of the courage to betray the secrecy of a closed system?
You know, that is a very good question, Gene, and I'm not sure that I can give you a real definitive answer. Courage is, we define courage in multiple ways, but the kind of courage that you're talking about, that's, in my view, living to a virtue. If you have an absolute value system, and most people do not today. Today we tolerate something we call, and I use tolerate probably from my own bias, so let me get that on the table, something called cultural relativity. For example, I recently interviewed a fellow by the name of Neil Donald Walsh, a very popular New Age writer.
Conversations with God.
That's correct. And Mr. Walsh informed me that because we were discussing a young girl who had been seriously injured by her husband. In fact, this was a 14-year-old girl whose nose and ears were cut off. You may have seen Diane Sawyer talk about this on the news. But before it became known here in America, this young girl was sold by her parents to a man to be his bride. She failed to please him, so he cut her nose and her ears off and put her out in the stable. She managed to crawl to her parents' home, but it would have been wrong for them to let her in according to their system of values, so they closed the door and wouldn't allow her in. Eventually, some women took her in, and I'll get this plug in if you don't mind, George, because I do support this charity. It's Women for Afghan Women. Well, according to Neil Donald Walsh, you can't blame the people involved, because they're raised to believe that this is the normal, this is the ordinary, this is their value system. So there's no fault to be placed there. Because there is no fault to be placed there, our value system that says how horrible that was to do that is absolutely prejudiced and has no place in their environment. Well, I took exception to that. I do believe that we have to find virtues. Like, you know, the great Greek philosophers, without the virtue, you know, everything becomes just a matter of whatever popularity decides it should be. In Walsh's word, whatever 50 plus one decides, 50% plus one decides, that's the way it should ought to be. We can look around the world and see many instances where 50% plus one led to just atrocity after atrocity. We can look today at what our president told all Americans when he stood up this evening and said, we went into Libya to save lives. This was a humanitarian mission. And we can judge that, and we can decide, well, was that an act of courage? Was that a justified call or not? In my view.
And was it even legitimate?
Well, that's, legitimate is another, right? And I'm not going to go legitimate. In my view, there are acts that require extreme courage that come from a principle standpoint. If you subscribe to cultural relativity, well, you know, that's a different issue. I don't. And as such, it would take a lot of courage for somebody to go outside the secret system, to risk everything in order to, you know, right a wrong. Especially a wrong that really couldn't be righted. And in this particular instance, may have even injured the cause that was the long term. That's a very difficult decision that person had to make. Let me, if I can, Gene, answer it this way. I'm going to go roundabout at you. In my latest book, What If, The Challenge of Self.
By the way, I love that title.
Thank you, George. We have 22 thought experiments. I'm going to give you a real short one, because part of the problem that comes in your question is in coming to the decision individually. And what I don't do in the book is tell you what I think you should decide. The individual decision is your individual growth, your individual manifestation of how you are experiencing your experience, your spirituality, in my view. So here's a thought experiment. And this thought experiment, all of these thought experiments are absolutely based on real cases, real live instances. Imagine you're a police officer and you're responding to a domestic call. You arrive at the home, you knock on the door, a woman, maybe in her 50s, opens the door. She is trembling. Her entire body is heaving with sobs, and she's shaking. She can't talk. She's so overwhelmed with grief, with sorrow. All she can do is point. And she points inside the living room, and you look, and there is a teenage girl, and she has her feet up on the ottoman in front of her. She's sitting on a chair, and there on the ottoman next to her is a baby. It's a newborn baby. You can see the blood on it. Something's wrong. There's a color discoloration. So you hurry to this child, and you see that there is a plastic bag tied over its head. This is a brand new baby, and it's just been suffocated. Now, Gene, I'm asking you to actually put yourself into this, because this is a thought experiment, and so you have to participate in it that way for it to have its value. Now, imagine you're this police officer, and, you know, you and your wife, or you and your husband, in your instance, Gene, you've wanted to have children. You've tried for a couple of years to have children. Maybe you've even been to a clinic, a fertility clinic. You've talked about adopting. And here is this newborn child. The blood is still on it. It has been suffocated. It is on the ottoman. The mother is laying or leaning in this chair with her feet up on the ottoman, just nonchalant about it all. What is probably her mother is just sobbing in the background. And you happen to be in a state where you know the law, and so you know that the state has passed a law that essentially protects, or is designed to protect, midwives and physicians from stillbirth, wrongful death actions. And so as long as the umbilical cord is attached, this child is not an independent life, and therefore what the mother has done is legal. May not be moral, but it's legal. She cannot be prosecuted.
Sickening.
There you are. I mean, that's where I am, George. I mean, I am sickened by this entire thing, this whole scenario. But I don't know where you are, Gene, but you hold where you are right this minute.
Do you believe, Eldon, that there are more good people than bad people?
I do.
Evil people.
I do. But I believe that a lot of the good people do bad things because they don't know better. But, all right, now you're this police officer. Whatever your feelings are, Gene, hang on to them. Because now you're on vacation. You're in California. And there you are sitting in a cafe and looking out. It's a sidewalk cafe and looking out at a beautiful day. And a car rounds a corner very quickly, slams into a woman just coming out of a physician's office who she has just learned she's 3 weeks pregnant. This car hits and kills her. In California, that's a double homicide. The driver's had a couple of drinks. He's going to be charged.
He's in trouble. Yeah.
Well, it should be a double homicide. I mean, think of some of the killings that have happened, yep, including in California, by husbands that kill their pregnant wives.
If he wasn't drinking and it was purely an accident, would they still go after him?
Well, you know, I don't know, but let's just pursue the double homicide. We have a double homicide. However, in this same state, and here's where the dissonance comes in, and it goes all the way into our legal system and into, you know, our courthouses and our legislative bodies. In this state, that same woman, if she wasn't hit by the car, at 8 months of her pregnancy, could decide to terminate it and have a late-term abortion, and it's totally legal. Now, I'm not making any comments about abortion. I'm not talking about whether abortion is right or it's wrong. What I am saying...
Well, we've lost you, Eldon. We're going to have to call you back, and we'll get you right on again. Tommy, take care of that, if you would. Wow, zapped right at the end. We'll get him right back. Our special guest, he's in just a superb guest, by the way, Eldon Taylor. If you haven't been to his website, please do so, eldontaylor.com. And we're talking about his latest work called What If, the Challenge of Self-Realization. I'll take another call. I'll play his role. Let's go to Rafa in Edmonds, Washington, first-time caller. Rafa, welcome to the show. Go ahead.
Wow, thanks, George. I was just going to say good morning to you and Eldon, but I guess I'll just say good morning to Eldon anyways. Marvelous show, very powerful program.
And he's back for you, Rafa, so he's listening to you.
Great, great. Hi, Eldon. I just wanted to run a real
quick
question.
They didn't like what I was saying.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Rafa.
Oh, I was going to let Mr. Taylor finish.
No, I was kidding, George. I was, you know, about to say, apparently they didn't like what I was saying, and so they censored me.
That does happen. George, you would have my vote, just to let you know.
Well, at least I'd have one.
Hey, I offered a campaign for the guy.
Well, get you started. Hey, I'm over here in Edmonds. Let's get it started, right?
That's two. I'm on a roll.
Okay, we got you going. My question, and I'm really looking forward to tomorrow night's show, by the way, George, really looking forward. I mean, I've been listening since Art Bell. So, first-time caller, pet telepathy, have you ever studied it, even informally? I think I've had it happen to me.
Yeah, you know what? There's no question about it, that telepathy, intuition, is probably one of the strongest points of humanity. If you can use it, if you can tap into it, you can do some incredible things. We'll be back with final phone calls and Eldon Taylor on Coast to Coast AM. On our next Coast to Coast program, the search for Bigfoot. Various experts in the field of cryptozoology will be joining us as we talk about the latest findings, discoveries, and technology. Get ready for that. And when we come right back with Eldon Taylor, we'll take final phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. And Eldon, before we take final calls, will we ever get that answer? Who are we? Will we ever find out?
You know, I believe that that's a process. I think one of the problems that people have is they have been trained all of their life to expect definitive answers. You know, you went to school and you had to know the true or false, the multiple choice, names, dates, places. And in that process, we come to think that we know what things are as soon as we put labels on them, which is wrong, and we come to expect that there is a certainty to any question that we ask. I believe that if we're going to ever know ourselves, we're going to live into it. And I mean that seriously. We will live into ourselves when we take the time to experience life in its fullness. And that means, you know, to to make the difficult decisions, to discover who we truly are, to cut through all the programming and all the biases and assumptions and the pure automatic that so many people operate on today. I mean, we call it the adaptive unconscious, but it's just automatic. We do so much of our lives, like we sign our name or the way we drive long distance, just on automatic, that we miss a great deal of what life has to hold. Like, you know, Gene's question about courage. Actually taking these questions and dealing with them up close and personal, coming to our own full understanding of them, is how we learn who we are. It's how we learn what we really feel and believe, as opposed to, you know, how we take the sound bites. That issue with Gene is not—it's not a pro-life or a pro-choice issue. It's what do we consider life to be, and you know, if when we sort things out, whether it's that voucher that we're talking about for schools, or it's what is life and is it sacred and when do we protect it and under what circumstances? When we really look at the issues, we discover that we haven't been. And in that process, we begin to wake up to who we are and what it is that we genuinely feel is right or wrong. I mean, maybe there are people listening to the show that think, I'm all wet. You know, their cultural relativity is how it should be. You know, whatever 50% of the population plus one decide is morally correct, that's how it ought to be. And if they have truly come to that conclusion, through their own feeling and rational best processes, then woe be it to me to say otherwise. But I would encourage that unless you do that, any other level of thinking, any other sense that you might have of who you are is bound to be false to fact. You're going to think you know yourself, and we know that most people simply do not. You're going to think you make your choices, and let me tell you, the unconscious mind is making all your choices for you, and that's just a fact. That's a part of the programming that's there. We witness that on a regular basis, and especially with today's technology, there's absolutely no question about it. The areas of the unconscious in the brain give you all the things that you're going to carry out as conscious. So if you're going to change anything, if you're really going to have free will, you're going to have to change the content that's in the unconscious. You're going to have to go in and change that programming. And to change it, you have to discover it. You have to know what's in there. You have to get past all this programming you and I have been talking about, George, and really, you know, stand in front of that mirror as though you had the amnesia and question the foundations of everything you believe. Everything I believed was wrong?
And what if everything you believe is right?
Yeah, that too. That too. But the only way I'm going to know is if I question it.
Exactly. We have a text in from Jan from New York, wants to know, can you train your mind to have the power, for example, to make yourself stop smoking? I would say yes.
And you're right. And the answer to that is absolutely right. Indeed, there's a quick trick that I can help her with there, because I smoked 3 packs of cigarettes a day, every day for 35 years, George. And, you know, I thought cigarettes were my friend. They assuaged anxiety. When I was on loan surveillances, I had a cigarette to keep me company. So how I would do that without him, I had no clue, okay? All these misconceptions. But I think I've used this analogy before, but it is so powerful. What we want to do when you're training your mind is change the context in which we hold things. We talked about definitions, touched a little bit on context. But if you think of context this way, if you think of the saliva in your mouth and you realize you're glad you have it, it tastes good to me. Some people don't want to admit that their saliva tastes good, but I'm sure glad mine is there. If it doesn't taste good, it doesn't taste at all, but I certainly don't want a dry mouth, and I'm glad I have my saliva. But if I spit my saliva into a little glass And then I think about drinking it back. Everybody says, oh, that's
gross.
Horrible. Hey, right. And you know, when you think about this, it's not out of my mouth, but a second or two. So why on earth would the saliva in my mouth be wonderful? I'm going to reframe it, though. Watch the words. But the spit in the glass be vile. Well,
it's all about the words.
It's all about the words. It's all about my definitions and my context. If when I realize that that cigarette isn't my friend, that these tobacco companies are going to rob me the rest of my life, that there are certain things I'm simply not going to do because I'm a smoker, that I'm going to be a part of an outcast group, and on and on and on. When I realize all the facts about what a cigarette really is, the context changes, and it becomes the spit in the glass, not the saliva in my mouth. So training our mind isn't just about mind over matter. I'm going to hypnotize myself, and I'm going to tell myself, you know, I don't smoke, I don't smoke, I don't smoke, or whatever. It is also, changing that stream of consciousness is critically important. I'm not making light of that. That's very important. But it's also about reframing the context. When I begin to see it for what it is, not for the context I hold it in, it loses its power on me. And, George, I'm telling you, I went to bed one night. I went through a whole list of what cigarettes really were. You could ask my wife. It was the night before Easter several years ago. And I looked at that list, and I realized, you know, you are a real guppy, dude. Look at everything. Everything that they were. I went to bed that night. With that context, I got up the next morning. I didn't have a cigarette. It was the end of the day before my wife noticed that I wasn't smoking. And she said, yeah, I haven't seen you have a cigarette. No, I quit. I'm not having any more. And that was after 35 years of three packs a day smoking.
Cold turkey.
Well, you can call it cold, but it was a matter of just changing the context. You know, I had all the other motivation, all the self-talk I was doing. I was using one of my own inner talk programs. But without the context, all that inner talk program did was make my cigarettes taste nasty. Made me want to break the CD, you know? So it was a matter of changing the context. The answer to your question is absolutely you can train your mind. And part of that is all in the information side of it.
Let's go to Scottsdale, Arizona, on the Skype line. Hello, Maggie. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you both for being of service. I wanted to put this out there first, since related to my question, is I would like for the Coast listeners and the host and everyone associated to send love to the waters of Japan. And I think that could be transformative and very powerful.
Okay. Thank you.
And I also wanted to ask him about what he was talking about at the beginning of the show, because I used to do relaxation with patients, and they would always request the ocean tape. And I would play it, and they would become very restless. And for years, I couldn't figure that out. And finally, a patient came up to me that lived near the ocean and said, "That's a storm surf." So I'm wondering why he chose that for his experiment, and if he has anything interesting to say about the effects that the ocean has on us.
Okay, sure thing. And why does the ocean have a calming effect on us?
I think probably the preponderance of opinion there has to do with the sounds of the womb. You know, womb sounds also are very soothing. They're primordial sounds. Water tends to be relaxing. Now, the reason, Maggie, I used it was the distractor. I could just as well have used something else. The experiment was not truly about the effect of ocean sounds or nature sounds on the relaxation response. The real reason for the experiment was to evaluate the influence of subliminal information on the physiology. had we said to people, subjects in the experiment, had we said to them, we're going to play you a subliminal and we're going to measure your physiological feedback, we would have perhaps predisposed them to expect something. By telling them what we were doing was expecting them, and indirectly we were telling them that, expecting them to relax because of ocean. What we were doing was measuring the relaxation response relative to ocean waves. They didn't anticipate, nor were they aware, even in the post interview, that a subliminal content was there. This way, we had a flat baseline, but when that danger message came, we saw galvos and pneumo needles just jump off the chart. They weren't consciously aware that they had even processed that danger message. It was only in the debriefing that we informed them of what the real content of the and purpose of the study was. And it was in the debriefing, by the way, that we learned that many of the people who received the danger message, their reverie included things like I was in the jungles of Vietnam being attacked. I was on the beach and there were sharks. Danger reverie. I hope that answers your question.
Thank you. Let's go to Oklahoma City now. Get in as many as we can here. Robert, go ahead.
Good morning.
Morning.
I do a meditation where I look inside of myself and come up outside of my thoughts, and it seems to help me become unhypnotized. But I was wondering if you have any techniques that you use to become unhypnotized.
Well, what you're doing, Robert, is one of the first things that I suggest people do, you know. If you go to your cardiologist today, he'll tell you to meditate. I can remember years ago when I started meditating, this same friend of mine that I mentioned earlier, the chief of police, called my home and the housekeeper answered, and he said, "Hey, you know, is Eldon there?" And she said, "He's meditating. I can't disturb him." And he said, "He's what?" Well, that was, you know, maybe 30 years ago. I took a lot of heat for meditating 30 years ago, but today...
It's the end thing.
Yeah, well, and it should be, because it is a healthy thing to do, and it is a good way for us to get a look at ourselves, at least still the mind to where we can examine our chatter. I think, you know, my favorite way, Robert, is to literally dissect my beliefs. That takes, you know, something everybody knows is a Ben Franklin tally sheet. You know, when you basically create a tally sheet, and on one side you list all of the issues but you can take any issue, and you're going to have what people today say is the left view or the right view, the liberal view or the conservative view. And when you list their arguments behind an issue, and then you really look at the issue yourself, you maybe even attempt to experience it vicariously. See, the thought experiments that I put in What If, I put in there because they're the pattern I use on myself to genuinely explore my beliefs so that I can say with a certainty, this is what I believe and this is why. This is who I am. This is where I stand. I wouldn't tell anybody what to believe. You have to do that for yourself. But that thought experiment method, in my opinion, is the best way to uncover some of these biases, what you call hypnotized. And see, the problem with a lot of these biases is they're hidden away from us. Indeed, there is on the web, you can Google a Stanford bias test, implicit bias, and you will find that there is a series of tests that you can take to uncover biases. But we all have them. Sometimes they're racial, sometimes they're against ages, sometimes they're, you know, they go in all kinds of directions. And uncovering an implicit bias requires us getting out of ourselves and literally exposing our beliefs to the outside in ways for us to discover that. And I know no better way than thought experiments.
All right, let's go to Matt in Salt Lake City, Utah. Matt, we've only got a minute for you. Go ahead.
Hi, George. I too was have been a close listener for the longest time. I think back in the 90s, I tuned in for the first time.
Thank you.
I think it was 92 when Art Bell was hosting, and he talked about Bottomless Pit in called Mel's Hole.
Mel's Hole. Yeah.
Yeah, that was great. Elton, I just want to let you know that when you're talking about the pets in the afterlife, I know they're there, and I know that they come to you in all different ways, just like you with the cow and the other lady whose dog came to her through her hypnotist. My dog, I had a dog once, and I had him from a pup, and he was a super dog, smart as a whip. And anyway, he died about 12 years old through a bunch of seizures, and I had to put him down. And you know, when a lot of people are going to think I'm a sap for saying this, but you know, I cried for days, and I looked right in his eyes, told him I was sorry for having to do this. And he came to me. I was talking to a friend because I'd really been in nutrition. He came to me, and she was telling me about this mineral stuff that I should take. And meanwhile, I was hearing this dog bark really loudly and strongly in the background.
Well, I'll tell you one thing, too, Matt. You're not a sap. You love animals, and that gives you points in my book, to be sure. Eldon, my friend, thank you for being on the program. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesour, Stephanie Smith, Ross Mitchell, George Knapp, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.